qua non ci deve essere più niente. Bisogna cominciare subito. Coraggio, al lavoro, buttate giù. Dico bene, autore?
Sì, grazie. Arrivederci, ragazzi. Ci vediamo in un prossimo film.
Lo speriamo.
Welcome to Cinema Italia, a podcast dedicated to the world of Italian cinema. Presented by me, John Bleasdale. And welcome to Cinema Italia. My name's John Bleasdale. I'm a writer and film critic. And today I am joined by the writer and critic Nicholas Bell, who writes for Eye on Cinema, amongst other places. And today we're going into nunsploitation, the subgenre of Italian horror that, I tell you the truth, Nicholas, I think this is might be my one of my first real sort of going to the source of nonsploitation. I've seen more recent examples, but yeah, what's your experience? When did you get into this kind of movie?
I remember the first time I saw this film was I saw the DVD on a shelf at Best Buy. I was probably a freshman in college, and I was familiar with Anita Ekberg. So I was like, oh, what's this? This looks amazing. Thinking it was kind of like a giallo film. And I think this was also kind of my introduction to the subgenre known as nunsploitation. And it was also my introduction to Joe D'Alessandro.
Right, of course. I mean, this has a really cracking cast. I mean, I want to be careful how I frame this because I don't want to say they're slumming it exactly. but you know, you have Alida Valle from The Third Man and from, you know, 100 other films. You've got a pre-war career. You've got the guy whose name I'm going to...
Oh, yeah, Lou Castell, yeah.
Yeah, he's in there as well. And of course, Anita Ekberg, La Dolce Vita herself.
You know, I think these kind of films you develop a better appreciation for, because I think a lot of us are introduced to, you know, what cinema is supposed to be and then kind of other things cinema can do that are, I don't think this is a good film, but I think this is a really fun film. So I've watched it many times throughout the years, and each time I find myself finding elements of it that might not stand out at first because you're distracted by how cheesy it is. And I actually prefer watching it with the dub version. I think the English dubbing sounds, it kind of enhances it in a way that is disarming.
That's an interesting point. I did watch it in Italian, which is not to say it's not the dubbed version, because I think pretty much half of the cast are being dubbed by other people anyway, even in Italian.
Right.
Yeah, that's always an interesting question when it comes to Italian cinema. You know, for instance, the spaghetti westerns are all dubbed into English, obviously. But I had an Italian who was saying, oh, you're not watching it correctly if you're not watching the Italian version, because that's the version Sergio Leone actually understood.
Right. I usually agree with that sentiment. I would almost always prefer to watch something, but I think it might be nostalgic because that's the first time that I watched it as that. So my mind is used to how that track sounds as well.
It's a little bit, I remember listening to John Woo movies Hard Boiled and seeing it first in a dubbed version. So that version is always in my head. Even if I'm watching it subtitled, I'm still hearing the American voice going, X-rated action, little piss pants.
Yeah, that was your formative experience with it. But so, yeah, usually I don't think that I would always prefer the native language, but this one's fun. I think this one's fun either way. I have seen the Italian dub version as well, but I don't know. There's just something that, cause it's sleazy in a way, but it could be sleazier. And I don't know. It kind of gives it a little bit of levity as well. And I think the film kind of stands up to some interesting psychological analysis with what its characters are doing too.
We'll get into it. Let's have a sort of crazy, if you like, of the or what the setup is to begin with.
So it's as it tells us as it opens, it's based on a true story from a Central European country. And it turns out that's actually true. There was a earlier, because this film's 1979, and earlier that decade, there was a Belgian nun who was killing elderly patients and was also addicted to morphine. So that was something that was probably already forgotten by the time this was made. But so this focuses on Sister Gertrude, played by Anita Ekberg. And we're introduced, well, actually, even before we're introduced to her, we hear a confession of some, we assume it's her for most of the film, probably, of some nun basically saying she hates men, wants revenge on all men, assumedly was sexually assaulted. Then we see Sister Gertrude waking up, making her rounds with all these patients that she's taking care of in this this medical facility of this medical Catholic facility. And then it seems that everybody's aware that she's got a big problem with morphine. It turns out she had a brain tumor that was benign. She became addicted to it because of then. And the current doctor, played by Massimo Serrato, correct me if I butcher any Italian names, by the way, who's been in a ton of stuff. I always think of Don't Look Now for him.
Yes, but, of course, he's the priest in Don't Look, the bishop, yeah. I should say, in Don't Look Now. Yeah,
very recognizable face.
He's a bit of a silver fox, isn't he? He's a bit as what a foxy character.
A tan, handsome man. Yeah. He said she's like, basically, I need to be taken in for observation because I'm still having problems. And he's basically like, girl, you're fine. I'm not giving you any more morphine. She gets pissed and gets him removed as the head doctor by the board of directors, and decides to go out on her own to get morphine, which she's able to pay for because she steals jewels from an elder, in a very cruel scene in which she breaks an elderly woman's dentures at breakfast. So she buys morphine and gets done up in the city and has a secret sexual liaison that plays like something out of Cruising. Just makes eye contact with this man. He follows her and they have sex. And I believe it's a stairwell. And then she goes back to work and killings start happening. and it's all, they're all presented in a way that we think it's her doing the killing. I don't want to ruin the film too fast, but
I think in terms of spoilers, I honestly think that this really doesn't matter because I don't think there's anybody above the age of 8 who would be watching this and not understand almost from the first 3 scenes. Oh, I see who it is. So I think we can, yeah, if you really want to be, you know, watch this film fresh, go away now, watch it and come back to the podcast. Everybody else, you can.
Right, right. Yeah, it is, to be fair, clearly obvious, especially because her roommate, this much younger actress, Paola Mora.
Yes, Paola Mora. And she's got a very slim filmography. There's not many
films.
Yeah,
and they give her an introducing credit in this, but she had already been in stuff. She was actually in Behind the Convent Walls right before this, Valerian Borachik, the guy who did La Bête.
Right, the Beast. Yeah.
Yeah. And so she's not her first film. Anyway, we see her naked. Out of all the bodies we see the most, it's her we see. But she is a lesbian and she is obsessed with Sister Gertrude. She's burning the x-rays from Gertrude's medical file to prove that she actually might. There's no evidence that she's fine physically, so she can get the treatment she wants. Gertrude keeps rebuffing her. But the murders that keep happening are patients that have done something that Gertrude would have a motive to kill for, that like they're gossiping about her, et cetera. Meanwhile, the head doctor's been removed and a new doctor shows up, the much younger Joe D'Alessandro. And he really doesn't have much to do, but where I think there are some interesting things happening is, especially once we understand the background of Paola Mora's character, Sister Mathieu, is that she offers herself sexually to D'Alessandro's doctor as a distraction from him suspecting Gertrude of doing anything. And to me, I find that kind of moving because it's clear that she hates men. She's not attracted to men. There's a very teary scene suggesting fellatio where she's offering herself to him. Anyway, Lou Castel comes in because he thinks it's Sister Gertrude. She does act untowardly. She locks him in a basement and takes away his crutches.
Gertrude is not nice to him. Sorry, not.
Yeah, she's not a. She's not without faults in all. One of my favorite scenes actually is Sister Mathieu is trying really hard to have a sexual liaison with Gertrude, and she really kind of demeans her. She gets this kind of dominatrix side of her going and calls her all sorts of things and basically is just being very manipulative to her. And earlier in that film, that ring she stole from the woman with the dentures, she shows the ring to Sister Mathieu and goes, "Oh, my mother gave me this when I became a nun. I don't know why, but I was going to give it to you, but since I need my drugs, you'll never have it."
Yeah, well, a complete bitch.
She's just a bitch. So it all ends where finally the Mother Superior, Alida Valli, steps, who doesn't want to nobody calls the police ever. There's these murders happening. They're all unhappy accidents, according to the Mother Superior, basically has Gertrude locked up. And then the film drives it home and confirms for us in the end that it is indeed Sister Mathieu who is the killer nun.
Yeah, and you get a series of sort of flashbacks where you see again the killings, but this time it's Sister Mathieu with the sort of the candelabra in the library and the lead pipe in the sitting room and whatnot.
Right, the some of these extravagant kills that don't work that well, maybe, but kind of give the film also a giallo vibe. And I would also add that it's certainly a nunsploitation film, but it's also kind of a nurseploitation film.
This is, yeah, there's a lot of medical stuff going on here and sort of slight, there's an element of slight body horror. There's a very interesting sort of scene of vision that Gertrude has of her own brain surgery, which is kind of quite grotesque and explicit, shall we say.
Yeah. And I think people expecting both, you know, having a familiarity with the genre already in Italian cinema and knowing Anita Ekberg might have been expecting to see not that part of her body.
I mean, this is really playing with her persona as well, isn't it? I mean, it is doing a lot. She's doing a lot of work in the film. I mean, she's acting her socks off. I mean, it's Grand Guignol, but it's she's up for it. You know, she's never. It's interesting. And the definition of camp is somewhat slippery, but it's never too winky, if you know what I mean. There's never a sense that she's in on the joke.
No, everybody in it's taking themselves quite seriously, which I think adds to its charm. Like this is there were some serious elements here. And, the director, Giulio Baruti.
That's right, yes.
This is his second and last film. And I believe he went on to do kind of work in nonfiction, like that, because the reaction to this film was disappointing. But I think he brings that sort of element to the story. And, you know, I've never seen his previous film, which is about a prostitute taking revenge on three Johns, I think. And I've only very lazily looked for it. I think the English language translation is "We Are Like Fireflies" or something, but I'd imagine I might enjoy that as well. But yeah, Ekberg is, I think the glory of it, you know, she has a quote that I always really liked, because she, like a lot of aging actresses who were, you know, revered for their beauty in their youth, I know she had issues with weight and was talked about a lot in the press that way. But she had a quote that was something along the lines of, "It's not cellular obesity, it's womanliness." But what I love about the nun's habit and what they're doing with her is you really focus on her face. And I think there are a lot of, she's wearing too much makeup for a nun, but her face is beautiful and striking and captivating.
There's a lot of close-ups on her eyes, and of course she's having to she's being tormented in this in this hospital as well by the fact that she keeps thinking, "I'm being accused of these murders," and proclaiming her innocence, and you're thinking, "Oh well, it's because she's got two personalities or something."
Yeah,
but it's actually genuine. But her sort of anxiety and her trauma is kind of really well played.
I agree, and I mean, I guess is taken to the logical extremes of she starts becoming violent in her defense of her reputation.
Yeah.
Because Another scene I giggle at is that garden scene, which I guess I was reading because Arrow Video put out a really nice Blu-ray of it a couple years ago, and there's a insert essay, and because you'd never tell from watching, but apparently they were having budget issues and some of the cast wasn't getting paid. So in that garden scene, I guess the director was trying to get close-ups because there were people there were part of the cast protesting during the filming of that scene. But I love that scene because they're all the patients are outside. They're having like a day of reverie, like a picnic day, and they're like, "We're going to play the truth game, and we want Sister Gertrude to be the first player."
It's just, and she's up for it as well. She's like, "Oh yeah, that's a good idea. That'll ease tensions. Nothing
right?
Could
like,
possibly
yeah,
go wrong.
Don't ask me anything too bad. I was gonna give you ice cream for dinner."
Yeah, exactly.
And it goes south so fast.
I love the way as well. There's an in joke in that scene where all the patients seem to be dressed in costumes that look like other films. Like there's someone dressed as Dirk Bogarde in Death of Venice, and there's like a communist guy who's from an old Italian comedy, I think, with a red scarf, and there's someone in a tracksuit, and I'm sure that's a reference to some other film, maybe.
The guy in the tracksuit, we meet him, he sleeps in his tracksuit.
Yes.
And she's like, I think she says, like, "This is not sanitary, why are you doing this?"
It's a little bit One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in that sort of like little ensemble of sort of slightly crazy characters.
Yeah, she arguably is on that Nurse Ratched spectrum of caring for these people but abusing them, manipulating them. There's a Glenda Jackson movie, I think late 70s. One of the titles might have been The Devil is a Woman, kind of like the von Sternberg film, but she's doing something very much like this as well. That's a much more demure film by comparison. But yeah, I think part of this character of Sister Gertrude's kind of a well-grooved archetype as well. But One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, because we get a lot of time with the inmates, which I find interesting. One of whom is it Laura Nucci. She's the she's got that kind of purple hair tint, and she's a baroness, and she wants breakfast in her room.
That's right. She says, let's not be formal. You can call me the baroness. Yeah, no formality. You could just address me as the baroness.
And if you watch it, especially with subtitles on, because I watch even things in English, I will watch with subtitles, but you catch so many bits of dialogue off screen with these characters, because Laura Nucci's, the baroness, has some other inmate who gets murdered following her around, and she's kind of advising her on how to be a lady. And she's like, a lady's never hungry.
Brilliant piece of advice. A gentleman always is.
Yeah, right. But there's all these like weird details in this film that you could miss out on.
I thought that about the actual hospital itself, the sort of, which is a strange hybrid of hospital and you know, asylum. There's an element where at one point she walks down the corridor and says, "Everybody here is just hypochondriacs. There's nothing wrong with you." Which is, of course, her projecting her own disappointment about not being allowed any more morphine. But also, it seems to be there's an element of truth here. There is quite a few people there's some people who seem to be obviously physically have ailments. There's a woman who has some sort of palsy condition and she's shaking. There are several elderly gentlemen, one of whom gets thrown out of a window.
Right.
In a very, it's obviously a dummy sort of way.
And immediately someone screams, "Oh, he killed himself."
Yeah. Don't call the police, he killed himself.
Yeah, but everybody should know. Sister Gertrude, when D'Alessandro just strolls up, I think he's introduced at the garden party. He just walks onto the premises and he's kind of mobbed by everybody. And Gertrude starts becoming very condescending. And I think that's where she says, you can all meet with him one-on-one and tell him about your imaginary complaints. And then tells him that they're all spoiled children.
And they deserve to be treated like such. And he's like, "No, I think I'm new medicine, young doctor, new medicine, new ideas."
Right. And again, he has nothing to do in this movie, really, considering what I think people would expect from Joe D'Alessandro in a film at this point. They make him kind of investigative because he's like, "I looked over the last doctor's notes, who you said was inept, but actually everything's in order. Not one wrong diagnosis.
Yeah. Well, which obviously you can tell. It's just like by reading notes, you can just tell that that's fine. Yeah. I mean, he's already sort of, again, I mean, he's kind of quite famous at the time that this film is made. He's already made his Andy Warhol movies. And I mean, I don't know him very well. I mean, this is how famous he is. I don't know him very well, but the minute he turned up, I thought, oh, I know that guy.
Yeah, because I remember watching that. This is the first film I'd seen him in. I was watching with somebody who was a gay man that was like probably 15 years older than me. And then seeing Joe D'Alessandro got him very excited about the film. And I'm like, well, that's where I watched the trilogy of films after that, like Heat, Trash, and the other one, Flesh. And that film he did with Jane Birkin. I'm forgetting, it's a French language title, I'm forgetting it. But going back and watching his early work, he was kind of an exploitation figure.
I love these Italian movies because they're so random in terms of who turns up. You know, Telly Savalas will turn up in a Mario Bava film, or Joseph Cotton will turn up, and you'll suddenly be like, what's he doing in this? You know, I think it's essentially because, like with Clint Eastwood, they were kind of promised, you know, a satchel of money, and it probably won't come to America. You know, it's like doing a Japanese commercial. You know, you get the money.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, you get the money. You get a couple of, you know, a month in the sunshine, paid holiday, and it won't damage your reputation.
Right.
Little did they know about Arrow.
Right, and Arrow is bringing a lot of those back. It's like, I love Carol Baker's Italian phase. Those are, because, you know, especially then, like a woman reached a certain age and they'd be aged out. But in Europe, there might be a whole lot of people that would want to work with you. I think going in this film specifically, Alida Valli, I think, depended on that as well. Because, you know, she had, well, because she was in Hitchcock's Parodying Case. So she was a Hollywood import. But I've never learned about there was some kind of huge scandal with her that sent her back to Europe. And I was never sure what that was. I remember reading something somewhere years ago, but her 70s phase is interesting though. Cause she's also in Suspiria.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Talk about horror legacy, horror heritage.
Right. Well, Eyes Without a Face too, but,
of course. Yeah, absolutely.
But she doesn't have much to do in Kill or None. She has more to do, more presence in Suspiria. But her first scene is pretty great because it's Anita Ekberg calling her and saying, the doctor won't give me morphine. Will you help me get admitted? And the mother superior goes, I've reviewed your file, you're fine. And then hangs up on her with Anita Ekberg going, bitch. It's so contentious.
I know. It doesn't take... I mean, everybody's on a hair trigger, but Anita Ekberg especially. By the way, I've just Googled the scandal because we can't leave it hanging like that. In 1953, her career suffered surrounding the death of Wilma Montese, whose body was found on a public beach near Ostia, which is quite close to where Pasolini died as well. Prolonged investigations resulted involving allegations of drug and sex orgies in Roman society. Among the accused, all of whom were acquitted, leaving the case unsolved, was Valli's lover, jazz musician Piero Piccioni, son of the Italian Minister of Foreign Affairs. Everything you want in that story. Politics.
That hits all the marks. Yeah.
I know, music, politics, Rome, death. It was a suicide. somebody shouted, don't call the police. It was a suicide. So there you go. Yeah, 1953. That capsized her sort of Hollywood career, apparently.
Wow. Yeah, which is too bad. I mean, she still did a lot of pretty damn good films. But again, even in Italian cinema, she was relegated to, you know, those kind of that branch of exploitation films. But I'm always very happy to see her. And I think the cast is really part of what makes this film if you know any of them, a lot of fun.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. I mean, and you know, as we were saying about Castell, that sort of intensity that he brings to the role, because here he has, as Piero, as the guy with the crutches, his sort of his key scene is trying to get himself up a flight of stairs using only his arm. A scene the drama of which is subtly undermined by the fact that as he's doing it, he's sort of dragging his pajama trousers down, and you can start to see his red briefs, and it's just like one of those, this should be a kind of agonizing moment, but I keep thinking, pull your pajamas up, for crying out loud.
I was like, oh, they just used that take. That was it. He's like, I'm not doing this again.
Yeah, exactly. Could you do it without wearing underwear?
Right. Yeah, that would make it a little more interesting. But I love how when he gets to the top, that's when somebody comes in and throws his crutches downstairs.
And stamps on his head a little bit.
Oh, yeah, that's when, yeah, it's in a very amusing. And works better. Some of the kills I don't love. There's a character... Is her name Janet?
The older lady who is, she's kind of got quite, she's actually, of all of them, she's the one that actually looks the most ill.
Yes, she looks
sort
like
of jaundiced,
right.
and thin, and, you know, ready to embrace the warmth of death.
Yes, she looks like she needs help. they do this thing where she's poking needles through her face and her eyeballs. Well, she just staying there and not screaming.
Yeah, she's not like in a wheelchair or immobilized in any way whatsoever. She just seems to be like reluctant to move too far away.
Right. Yeah, she's standing against the wall. Like, okay,
not my eye.
Right. And I think there's only like a strip of gauze put on her mouth, and it's like, this scene makes no sense. But you get the sense that we had to do something. Because the insert article in the Blu-ray was putting this in perspective of what the Italian cinema industry was like at this time, and kind of had a downturn in the 70s with ticket sales, and how at the time there was this three-tiered kind of movie house structure where the bigger, better films would be more expensive, but and then they'd filter down to the others, and then how television soaked up all the people that would go to the cheaper theaters. And so then those cheaper theaters started churning out playing porn films to get people back to the theaters. So you get the sense that by 1979, this feels a bit old hat.
It does feel like 79, doesn't it? It doesn't feel like the mid 70s at all. It feels like we're getting to a point. I think one of the other things that's, I mean, in a sense that the fact that we're in this sort of space between, the 70s and the 80s is similar to where we are geographically, because, you know, there's ambulance turns up and it's got French writing on it, and you know, yet it feels very Italian in terms of the doctor, and the cast is all over the place, so it has this sort of Euro soup mixture to it that is kind of has its own charm as well.
I agree, and I think that's how it gets away with that somewhere in Central Europe.
Yeah. I mean, when she leaves and goes out to the town, she's obviously not in Italy. There's signage around, which is not written in Italian.
Right. And they're not doing any work trying to pinpoint where we are exactly either. And probably on purpose, because I don't think they had a lot of money to make this. So it's just there. I do really like the score.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that.
Alessandroni.
Yes, excellent pronunciation, sir.
Thank you. He did a lot of scores, but I think he's probably best known for doing the whistle theme in A Fistful of Dollars for Morricone.
Yeah, they were friends and they were collaborators. And yeah, he was he was a multi-instrumentalist. He played lots of different, as indeed was Morricone, played lots of different instruments. But yes, he was the whistler, I think, for both the Dollars films. I absolutely certain he did one of the sounds for Good, the Bad and the Ugly as well, but I couldn't tell you which one.
Yeah, I feel like I saw that on his in his film credits, but I mean, which obviously is a very interesting piece of information. But I think what he's doing here is, especially when Sister Gertrude is getting her morphine, when it really seems to become prominent. I don't know. I think this is the type of score I could just listen to on its own too.
Yeah, he sort of starts mixing in sort of religious music, and there is a real Morricone theme to some of those sort of fat piano chords that he puts over it. But then it does become its own thing, and it does benefit from that as well. I think it has its own flavor.
For sure. And because none, you know, a lot of nunsploitation films, like if you really delve into the genre, a lot of them are derivative and forgettable. And I feel like when I think of nunsploitation, I think of something a little more. I think there are different kinds of nunsploitation, but like Ken Russell's The Devils to me is like, that's the pinnacle of this. And also taking itself very seriously, but also trying really hard to have shock value. Not unlike Verhoeven's Benedetta, I think that these choices are made of like, I really want to be erotic and provocative and kind of shocking in this taboo realm. And so Killer Nun to me is somewhere on it's a little bit on its own wavelength, even though it's classified as one of the most notable items in this film movement.
Well, I was going to ask that because, I mean, in terms of, I've never really thought of The Devils as nunsploitation, just because I've always thought of it as The Devils. It's just been in a different category in my head. Maybe that's misinformed. But what other sort of films would you sort of point at in this genre that The Killer Nun, you know, is together with? Was this genre as self-conscious as that? Were there people going, it's time we made another nun move?
I think that there was a theme, especially in the 70s. And I think, yeah, you're right. I don't think Ken Russell's The Devils can really be classified as such. I think it's elevated beyond that. But it was that 71. I think the outrage against that film got a lot of attention. And there were a lot of films that were trying to piggyback on that. So that's where you get like a lot of cheap derivative titles. Also, I think Pasolini's... Is Arabian Nights the first in his trilogy of life?
Yeah, there's Arabian Nights, Canterbury Tales, and...
Decameron?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
I'm forgetting the sequence of release of those, but I think that was also big enough to instigate all these copycats. Because technically you could... I've seen Mother Joan of the Angels also lumped into this kind of nebulous definition of what... It's like defining film noir a little bit. It's just a lot of common themes cropping up at the same time. I think the title we also kind of mentioned with Paola Mora, Behind the Convent Walls, that would be a pretty good example of nunsploitation as well. I think you see a return to that a bit with two releases this year. Immaculate with Sydney Sweeney could be nunsploitation, or even The First Omen.
Right. I haven't seen either of those. Have you managed to see?
Yeah, I think they both have some interesting things.
Are they as good as Killer Nun? That's what I want to know.
Oh, no. Nowhere near as fun. No.
Even Oppenheimer struggles.
I agree. I think they both have... You know, in 2024, talking about The Omen, the First Omen is a callback, obviously, to the original Richard Donner version as well. But it just doesn't have the same level of it doesn't hit the same, because I think culturally overall, we've moved beyond that, besides certain pockets and bubbles and communities that might disagree with me. But I think overall, culturally, these films don't have the same kind of impact across the board, where something like Immaculate is never going to strike a cultural chord like Rosemary's Baby, which is a film that it's paying a large debt to, for instance. as is the
first... That's a very polite way of putting it. I sense.
Yes, they're a little bit derivative, but even Killer Nun arguably is doing derivative things with some of its elements. And I think that... those kind of distinctions are impossible to avoid anyway, but I find it interesting that we still return to these themes, and not just in the US, of what it, I guess, exploiting these holy spaces.
Well, I mean, arguably, from an Italian perspective, this would definitely be kinky and would definitely have, you know, be playing into taboos and be like, oh, you can't do that. And even like, you know, when she's abusing the sister who is in love with her, and she, in Italian, she's saying, "Your sister whore," you know, and it's this, you know, like, "Sorella puttana, sei una suora puttana," and it's a brilliant sort of vitriolic and sacrilegious thing to be saying in the midst of, you know, while dressed as a nun, you know.
Right.
going back to that relationship as well, I love the fact that Paola Mora is, they both sleep in the nude with diaphanous kind of mosquito net, and whenever she wakes up, stands up and demurely covers her breasts. It's just like, it's just such a, what are you, okay.
I mean, all right,
I mean, you could just put pajamas on if you know, or a tracksuit.
Right, but you get the sense that she wants Gertrude to rip it off. And I like how Anita Ekberg's sleeping with her hair looks very well tended to. Anytime we see her outside of her habit, I mean, she looks like she was just at the salon, and also wearing makeup in bed.
As you have to.
I think in that scene too, she's tossing and turning, and she's basically asking Sister Matu for help because she can't sleep. It's like, well, what do you expect her to do for you?
You have to read between the lines.
They're playing. I think that the director's playing with that tension because we'd expect them to have a full-on lesbian scene. And we don't. Gertrude is, it seems, actually repelled by her, which I find kind of interesting. She's using her as a tool of manipulation, but not sexually. But so it kind of is riding against that code we'd already be expecting by then.
Which goes with a lot of things in this film, because, you know, the as you say, the sort of kills, and you would expect them to become increasingly gory, and they're kind of not. They kind of, you have one which is pretty horrible, and the rest of them are fairly tame. And you know, you have a scene where she's in, can't remember if it's a vision, but she's with a naked body, and it's of a man. And it's, again, it's kind of quite a weird, you know, fully naked. So you see everything, and she's sort of touching him lightly and coyly. And there's this mix of coyness and explicitness. I mean, you see someone sort of being fellated in a very kind of disturbing way, and then himself being sort of murdered in a very oral way.
I like that scene too, because it's so ridiculous.
I didn't say I liked it. It's disturbing.
It's entertaining. Rain is pouring down. It's like sheets of rain. Yeah. Gertrude's in her habit. She looks soaked, and she is witnessing this older man in a wheelchair with a woman who I also presume is a patient. He's begging her to fellate him, and she is doing it. And then he tells her to ride it like a jockey, like a horse jockey. Yeah.
Well, he hasn't lost it, has he? He hasn't lost it.
No,
patter.
It's a very vigorous sex scene. And I was trying to think of watching it. Wouldn't it be uncomfortable while the rain is pouring down to do that? But I guess it works because he's in a wheelchair.
He's got his brakes on.
Yeah, well, he must. There's a foundation. You know, it's the staging of it is made less awkward because of the wheelchair. I don't know, but
the blocking for the camera.
Right, it's just odd, but very entertaining. And of course, the film is trying to set us up because of that early confession that whoever the killer is hates men. So right. That scene where she's caressing that naked body and his penis is out there. Again, it's trying to make us think she's a split personality. And I don't think very well, but...
Yeah, it didn't really have me for a second, because it's like there's only two possibilities here. It's not like there are. It's either her or it's the other nun. The other nun, because whoever is. I mean, the title is The Killer Nun, and there are only two of them. So it's not wild guesswork.
Right. And then it's contradictory too, because she has that sex scene with all her clothes on with that man when she goes into whatever town she's in or city, and she seems fine with that.
That and she's sort of looking around and going, not him, he's too Italian. The cruising scene where she's picking him up.
Well, even how she's picking him up is so, she's very direct. I mean, she basically hikes her dress up to show her knees in front of everybody.
It's direct and sort of vaguely Victorian. Here are my ankles.
Right.
I know what magic these do. Trying to resist.
Right. And it's like, for a man, I mean, they're probably similar in age, those two actors. But it, I wanted some kind of dialogue from him, but that's what it almost feels like. That's why I mentioned cruising, because it feels like something you'd see in a gay film. Like, this is coded kind of queer, that this woman would be picking this man up this way, and there's no exchange. I mean, of course that happens, but just how we're used to seeing it is not this way.
And he goes straight away. I mean, they do their dirty and off he goes. And it's sort of like, thank you. I'm not even,
Yeah, that's it. And it's like, okay. And I mean, she's clearly feeling triumphant. She has her ampoules of morphine that we get to
She's
see
done
her
the
inject.
business. Yeah, exactly. She's achieved what the character wanted to achieve. So in the end, what we get is her sort of treated badly because she's not necessarily found guilty by the police because who knows where they are. But she is going cold turkey and finally having the revelation that it's a slightly Hitchcockian frenzy that you sort of she'd always known, she'd always see, witnessed the murders, but she'd somehow blocked them off. I wasn't quite sure if she sort of dies in the end because there's a bit where she sort of falls to one side and looks wretched, and I wasn't sure if that was meant to be signaling that that's it.
Yeah, the ending, I mean, because it's doing this, what it thinks is a reveal, is kind of disappointing. And also, I don't know what it's really suggesting, because if you locked up the woman that's not doing the killing, but she's her object of affection, won't things still be there? There will still be killing happening by Sister Mathieu, you'd assume, but.
I just assumed she had transferred her sort of lustful ways onto the doctor now. She was just gonna, despite her misandry, she was gonna pick up, and now he was gonna be the object of her desires.
And you know, going, I think that's where there really is some interesting some psychological footnotes for her, because the way she's approaching D'Alessandro is, don't, I can't leave, I must stay here. She's offering him one, yeah, she is distracting him from like questioning what Gertrude's up to, but also her own stability is kind of invested in this place, and she's dependent upon it. So she is going to try to gratify whoever's in charge of where she's going to be. So that's the sense I got from that as well, which I thought was interesting. So yeah, she probably would be transferring some of that. But then the film doesn't resolve that. I think, was it her grandfather that raped her as a kid or something? Reveal at the end, like, I think there will be trouble.
Extending this conversation to other films around about this period, not necessarily of the nunsploitation genre, which we've already spoken about, but this sort of late 70s, early 80s, this is when sort of Dario Argento is sort of beginning. He's still good, but he's entering the 80s. And Italian horror, as you were saying earlier, because of economics, is beginning to sort of it's not they've not got as many films being made and being exhibited as they have in the 70s. What other films around here would you sort of recommend if people are into Italian, this kind of Italian exploitation?
Oh God, I'd have to think about that. There's the nice thing about watching any of these films, they kind of provide a doorway to a bunch of other people, because the stuff I've read about this film, and you kind of had already said it, is that you don't want to say that they're slumming it, but I think by and large in their careers, this was a period where that could have been the accusation. But, you know, Castel was working with a lot of other really interesting people. He's also in Orgasmo with Carol Baker. Actually, Umberto Lenzi, I think all of his cycle of films are pretty good. I think Baruti had something to do, I don't know in what capacity, with, again, speaking, Carol Baker did this adaptation of Baba Yaga,
it's
an Italian film from 73. I think those are all kind of seedy, trashy things that are fun to watch, usually going in with probably lower expectation on a lot of those things. But if you kind of explore any of these people's filmography, they'll lead you to all kinds of very interesting, sometimes obscure, unfortunately obscure films that have been forgotten.
Well, a lot of these films are now becoming available, as you said, on DVD and some of the streaming. I've seen like some Shameless as a label have released a lot of these films or have them out there. So I think they have. It's hard to tell because sometimes I feel you know, you can give anything a really nice box set cover and a couple of essays, and I find myself going, no, isn't it just shit? Am I sure I want to spend my Saturday night watching this?
Right.
But in this case, I think we can definitely say no. I mean, there's a lot that is nonsense in here, but it is very enjoyable.
Something that just came to mind that I would, if you like this film, I would highly recommend the Italian director Giuseppe Petroni Griffi, who did a film, an adaptation of that is an Elizabethan era play, Tis Pity She's a Whore, with Charlotte Rampling. But he did this excellent adaptation, I think it's excellent, of a Muriel Spark novel called The Driver's Seat.
All right.
Did you ever see that?
No, I haven't, no.
It's Elizabeth Taylor. It's 1974. She plays this woman who we see her going to, I believe she's going to Rome, and she's acting very strange, and she meets a man on a plane and seems to be attracted to him, and then spends the rest of the film trying to get back to him because she recognized something in him she needs, and that need is to find the man that she wants to kill her.
Oh my God.
And Andy Warhol it shows up in it in one scene. But yeah, that's kind of, again, those the interesting intersections of like American stars with this 70s period of Italian cinema, I find fascinating. But that one, that was released at a nice Blu-ray box set called House of Psychotic Women.
It's right down my street.
Which is taken from the woman, I'm forgetting her name, that wrote a book called House of Psychotic Women. And these were a selection of four films that she highly recommended. But that one is a lot of fun.
Oh, brilliant. Oh, I'm going to put that on my list. I'm going to watch that straight away. And maybe you can come back and talk with me about it.
Oh, I'd love to, because I've read the book too, because I was so fascinated. It's just this weird film. It's a little bit forgotten. Some of Liz Taylor's later stuff is, she did this film with Joseph Losey called Secret Ceremony.
Oh, I've seen that. Burt Lancaster as well, isn't it, I think?
I think it's Mitchum.
Robert Mitchum and Mia Farrow, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's bizarre, and I don't know if that works all the time either, but it's just fascinating in a way that you don't see those kind of risks being taken a lot. But yeah, that Liz Taylor in Driver's Seat's a lot of, and I mean, she's a little shrill, if yeah, as she could be, but
late period Taylor, definitely. But that sounds excellent. Sorry.
As a footnote too of the what I was learning about the censorship code changing. Speaking of Elizabeth Taylor and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and how we in the U.S. developed the censorship system ended, and we got what the MPAA. So that allowed a lot of our imports from other countries like Italy were to satisfy the public craving for things that were more scandalous and adult. But once we could start showing those things ourselves, that also affected a lot of film industries like Italy's, with the US was just buying less of that kind of stuff because they started making their own during the new American cinema movement. That to me, which is the best studio era of American cinema, was that era when like, you know, Warner Brothers financed The Devils, which seems crazy, which is also why we can't really get a hold of it easily now. And, you know, The Devils, I think Vanessa Redgrave and Oliver Reed were banned from Italy for that film.
It wouldn't surprise me. Vanessa Redgrave had opinions.
For sure.
And married, is still married to, I think,
Franco
Nero.
Yeah. And before that, she was with Tony Richardson.
What a life. The what lives. I met her, actually. She was making the Aspern paper in Venice. And I was invited on set by just Ivory. It was
nice. I have a copy of that. That's a James adaptation.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And I haven't watched it because that's a James text I haven't read. I always want to read the text first usually. But yeah, that'd be amazing to meet her. I mean,
there was interesting because she had to fall on the ground and she wanted to fall on the ground. And they were saying, no, you don't need to fall. You just go down. You just bow down and we'll move the camera up and we'll cut to you on the ground. And she was like, no, I'm a dancer. I know how to fall. And they were like, love, you're 87. We're not going to have you throw yourself to the ground. It's day three, you know. And basically James Ivory turned to me and said, this is why I'm here, and walked over and persuaded her not to throw herself on the ground. But it was like a good hour of persuasion.
Oh, well, which, you know, I can understand her wish to want to do that, but it's also like, we can't afford, we don't want to break any hips today.
Exactly. Exactly. Brilliant, Nicholas. On that bombshell.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for recommending The Killer Nun. It's opened my eyes to nunsploitation. It might be nonsense, but it's not nonsense. I just made that up myself. Where can we find your work?
I write for ioncinema.com. I also write for Spin Magazine. And I have my own YouTube channel that I co-host with my husband called Fish Jelly.
Excellent. I will put links up to those, to the channel. And yeah, I'm looking forward to you coming back and discussing Driver's.
I'm down. That's another movie I could watch at any time. So you just let me know.
Brilliant. Take care, man.
You too.
Arrivederci ragazzi, ci vediamo in un prossimo film.
Lo speriamo.